The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Tech stocks take a beating on Friday. UK elections are over, not what was expected. Fed rate decision is in focus, and our guest today is Michael Easton from Fellowship Financial on the DOL rules and fiduciary requirements. All this and much more on episode number 513 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a good day to you. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I am the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me on what appears to be finally a sunny, well, partially sunny day here in South Florida. We've had rain for, I don't know, the last 6 or 7 days. I'm not talking about just rain, you know, drizzles and a storm here and there like we get usually in Florida during the summertime. I am talking about ridiculous Noah's Ark type of rain that has been just incredibly pouring down floods throughout the city and area, all the way from Miami up to Palm Beach. And I've seen people with, I'm not kidding about this, jet skis and airboats driving down the streets. You always get that going on when there's some incredible amount of flooding that goes on down here. People feel the necessity to get out their various little skiffs and jet skis and boats and make their way down the streets. A little bit nutty, if you ask me. But it has stopped raining, at least for the time being, so that's good to hear, good to know. We do have a lot of things to talk about. I'll mention first that, of course, you can find out more information about what we do, how we do it, the various portfolios that we manage for clients, because we do, in fact, manage about 4 different strategies for clients, from our Aero strategy, which is an algorithmic strategy that looks for overbought, oversold, and trending conditions in the S&P 500. That's called Aero, A-I-R-O. We also have the managed growth strategy, which does a bunch of hedging and also some core strategies with utilizing quantitative and fundamental screening of stocks, as well as utilizing a part of the Aero in there. You can find out more about this and all the different strategies right on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And if you're thinking maybe it's time that, hey, you know, I'd like to change up my portfolio. It's been riding along pretty well for some time in a standard, maybe, kind of a low-cost ETF scenario, and things have been riding well with the indices, and maybe it's time to look at some hedging or taking some chips off the table to rotate into a more actively managed type of portfolio situation. Well, these may be for you. So go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check that out. Now, in terms of some of the other things I want to go through and talk about, I think that we do have to spend a little time on what went on last week and some of the economics that we're leading into next week, because a few of them that are, I think, going to be pretty important for the markets. The first thing we know is that the UK elections are finally over, and Theresa May did, in fact, win as expected. There was a snap election that was called. They do a much different way of elections over there than we do, where we have our standard dates and they're, you know, consistently the same time and same period of distance between the two, every 2 years or 4 years or 6 years. But they decided, yeah, we're going to have a snap election in order to show that we have a majority control. The problem is that now we have a hung parliament. We have a much weaker party with regard to Theresa May, and possibly even there's some murmurs that she will be stepping down and Osborne will take over. But regardless of all that, what does this really mean? And what is the outcome of this election mean in terms of the geopolitical environment here? I think the basic issue that we have to look at is with regard to Brexit. It does weaken the case for some Brexit because we have some of the question as to whether or not many of the people that were voting were still in favor. And there was a very high turnout here. And if they're still in favor of this, and whether or not Europe and the Eurozone is going to be able to put more tightening requirements and kind of the screws to the UK in terms of their entire Brexit policy. the pound dropped about 1.75% at one point. I think it was actually down 2.5% at one point during the day after the election. And it came back a little bit, but still the pound was much weaker, indicating a much weaker environment and outlook for the UK economy. And that is good for stocks in some regard, because of course it helps their exports, but it also does put a little bit of a cloud over the level of strength of their economy without any other interaction by their central bank, the Bank of England. So that was a big story last week, and that really didn't have much effect initially on markets. As a matter of fact, I tweeted, which you can follow me at Andrew Horowitz, one word, Andrew Horowitz on Twitter. I said, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter the outcome of the election, just that there was an election that seemingly allows for investors to get really giddy and excited and start buying stocks. And that's exactly what happened here. We saw that on the heels of the election, even though it didn't go the way that would have been necessarily very positive for equities and for the economy, that, well, it's over. And maybe that's a relief and we're going to start buying stocks again. At least we don't have that cloud hanging over us. Who knows what would have happened if, in fact, there was a much greater voting turnout and reaction towards May, or if it was something much different, if the same thing would have happened. We've seen this time and time again here and overseas. When there's an election, just simply stocks go up afterwards. Kind of a fascinating set of circumstances. And I'm not exactly sure what the phenomena is there, but it is kind of interesting. We also saw on Friday a very, very wicked turnaround reversal, where we did see that the NASDAQ was once again reaching record territory. And then throughout the day, all of a sudden, it started to get a bit weaker, even though the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up very nicely, hitting an all-time record. The NASDAQ was very weak. Small caps were pretty strong, but the NASDAQ, particularly the FANG stocks and the large cap techs, really took a beating. Throughout the day, they were getting weaker. Towards about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday, though, there was just a massive panic sell-off. Amazon dropped like 40 or 50 points in just moments. It did recover part of the way towards the end of the day, and we did see a recovery post 3 o'clock in the afternoon to a degree. But still, by the end of the day, we saw the NASDAQ and the NASDAQ 100 off by about 2.3%. The S&P, again, was relatively even for the day, and the small caps were up for the day. But a really fascinating move there, and you have to wonder what that was all about, because there really is no explanation when you see just one sector starting to move so dramatically against all the other sectors. Was it simply that people were getting a little bit concerned that Apple maybe is using a different processor and possibly order flow is not going to be as great for the next upgrade cycle? I don't know. Maybe there was some murmurs about that, and NVIDIA got hit pretty hard due to the fact that the chip that they're using for Apple in some of their wireless is not as fast as the Qualcomm, which is used on other devices, and that may be a problem. And Apple got hit, and NVIDIA did a sharp reversal. It was up something like, I think, 2 or 3% after a major run from about 110 to about 150, and it just turned around. It was down about 3.5%, 4%. But you saw Microsoft and Netflix and Amazon and Google and Apple, and the list goes on and on, really sell off pretty hard on Friday. So we'll have to see how this really plays out, because is this a one-day wonder that all of a sudden just some profits are being booked and we're going to be rotating into maybe some of the small caps and the banks post the Comey hearing that did not shed a lot of light and any differential and didn't have any kind of real teeth in it to cause Trump any problems, and the whole administration then is freed up now to pursue their goals of lowering taxes and getting through the repeal and replace healthcare rules and their infrastructure bill, the repatriation, regulatory reform, all that. I mean, is that what's going on? Maybe that's a rotation out of that for some reason, possibly. But it definitely was something that should be looked at as an area of concern, at least to open up your eyes into that this is not a one-way street for stocks. And as a matter of fact, I talked about some of this on Frank Curzio's show. I was a guest this week. Go over to frankcurzio.com. You can listen to that. And I guess somewhere in that discussion, I really had talked about how I thought there was a bit of euphoria involved in stocks these days, where people are just buying to buy, not looking at valuations in some areas and really just going out and pushing money into the indices, which are naturally pushing up some of the large cap stocks. And there was an abundance of trading that went on in many of the larger cap stocks as a safety haven, a place that maybe, well, people thought couldn't really get hurt. And possibly what happened is there was, this realization. But listen to me discuss this on Frank Curzio's show over at frankcurzio.com. Before we get on to a couple other details and some things, I want to talk about some of the interesting and I think just some telling items from the economic reports last week. There wasn't a lot, but there were enough to start looking at the general trend of what's going on from an economic standpoint. And again, we know that lately the economic data doesn't really seem to be concerning anybody with rates so low and the potential for a fiscal stimulus agenda that may in fact be doing something to help buoy and to sustain the underlying bid in equities. Will it matter eventually? I think everything will come home to roost, and it always does. Sometimes it just takes a little bit longer. Sometimes it takes longer for people to get out of a malaise thinking that everything is terrible to a point where they're like, you know what, things are not so bad. And we're starting to see a couple of things tick up and they start buying in when things are really bad in a recessionary time period or a stock market sell-off, which is elongated. But right now we're still, I got to tell you, there's really nothing substantially wrong with the economy at this point. We know that we saw that employment's been chugging along pretty well. This week we saw productivity, and productivity, generally speaking, was at a 0% change, but forecasts were for a drop, especially when we saw productivity was down about 0.6% last month. Unit labor costs are rising, but not too quickly. It was 3% in the prior month. The most recent was now 2.2%. Factory orders did slow down a little bit, maybe because we saw some inventories that we're building and so possibly sales are slowing. We know that there's something going on in the retail space. A lot of bankruptcies, a lot of warnings. We saw what happened with Macy's again last week, issuing a major warning on their revenues. Stock was down about 8% before it recovered after there was some discussion inside of the space that there could be some privatization that's going on. And we did see that with that, the hope that private equity would step in, that many of the stocks did catch a bid through last week, even after they were hit again with this Macy's warning. ISM Services Index came in at 56.9. And that was a little bit lower, though. The services was definitely a little bit lower. And this is a trend that we've been seeing recently, that there has been a slowdown in the service sector. Other than that, we did see crude again sell off dramatically after a major build in inventories last week. We saw that MBA mortgage applications that came out on Wednesday were a bit higher than last. There was a bit of a slowdown in mortgage applications in the refinancing area. That did pick up a little bit. Consumer credit definitely ticked down significantly. Prior, there was a build of about $19 billion for the month. Expectations were for about a $15 billion rise. It only increased by $8 billion, getting back to the fact that consumers are spending less and needing less to borrow, put on credit cards, revolvers, in order to buy. So there's definitely a slowdown in the buying area. Initial claims came in about 245 and wholesale inventories down about 0.5%, which will obviously hit on GDP. Now, here's what's coming next week. Next week is a much more important week in terms of economics. On Monday, there's nothing coming out, but on Tuesday, we got PPI. We got the producer price index coming out. Expectations for about a flat number. Prior, it was up 5.5%. Now, that could be possibly because the dollar has come down a little bit and some of the currency transactions. It could be because spending isn't as great and inventories are rising. Therefore, the cost of the goods possibly have something to do with it. It also has to do with the fact that commodity prices have come down once again and the input factors are lower. So therefore, the PPI could be lower because of that. Retail sales are expected to be on Wednesday flat as opposed to up 0.4%, which, by the way, again, is a ridiculously low number. Of course, zero growth is very low, but other countries around the world, you may be seeing something like 1 or 2 or 3%. We're trying to get excited about, you know, 0.1% or a 0.2% rise in retail sales. Now, ex autos, we're going to hopefully see a retail sales that actually is positive. We do know there's been a slowdown, a very precipitous slowdown in auto sales. That's been going on for some time now. And that's something we actually predicted probably about 2 years ago when we started to see that the loan and lease term rates in terms of the amount of years that would take in order to pay off a car on average had reached 7 years, whereas just a few years before it was 4 and 5 years. So as they extended the terms of their loans, what happened is they really did a great job at being able to sell a lot of cars. But what happened is those cars became underwater financially for the consumer, therefore not allowing them to actually turn in cars at a reasonable rotation on a 4-year basis, let's say. And now maybe it's a 6-year basis. And therefore they took away from their future sales. But they knew what they were doing because they were hurting at that point, but they figured a creative way of financing cars. And therefore what they did was essentially stole from their futures. Now, we do know that also once PPI comes out, the CPI or the inflation rate is not too far behind. And on Wednesday, we're going to be looking for a negative 0.1 inflation rate. Core inflation rate is expected to be 0.2. So when you strip out the food and energy, we're expecting a 0.2 increase, whereas it was a 0.1 increase prior, but still relatively benign. Business inventories also looks like they're going to be lower. Now, on Wednesday, this is an important issue. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we're going to be seeing a Fed rate decision. There's a high probability that they'll be increasing rates again. I got to tell you, though, even if they do raise it by 0.25%, I still wonder whether or not this is going to be anything that they can actually pull off right now with the fact that they're seeing a little bit of a slowdown in the employment area and we're seeing the economy ever so slightly slow, GDP not picking up, and inflation benign. Unless they're trying to get really ahead of the curve, which is something they haven't done ever, at least in the last 10-year cycle, 10 years of a slow, methodical interest rate that hasn't gotten off emergency levels, you wonder if they're really going to be able to pull it off. On Thursday, we have a good amount of information as well. Philadelphia Fed Index, one that I look at quite often. Prior was 38.8, a very good number. Expectations to be dropping down to about 25. We're going to see export prices and import prices, as well as some initial claims, continuing claims. But importantly, we're going to be seeing capacity utilization, which looks like it's been holding steady at about 76.5. Industrial production, flat. And then also on Friday, we'll see housing starts, an important number, building permits, and the Michigan sentiment. The Michigan sentiment has been about 97. Expectations are for that to be dropping down. This is the preliminary number for June that's going to be coming out. Building permits are for May. Housing starts are for May also. Looking for a little bit of a slowdown, and we have been seeing a slowdown in some of the housing numbers recently. Not so much to get too concerned about. And there's some discussion about it being an inventory-related issue. I'm not so sure about that. We'll see how this plays out and how the next couple of months in housing actually plays out. So that's what you have coming up in the next week for economics. Again, the most important thing I think is going to be a combination of the inflation rates that we'll be seeing earlier in the week, as well as the interest rate decision by the Fed. I'm on the fence of whether or not they're going to raise or not. And then importantly, we'll see the Philly Fed and housing starts towards the end of the week. So There you go. Now, I'll mention what's... there's been some talk, and you've been hearing about the fiduciary rule and the Department of Labor rule and conflict of interest rule. There's a lot of different ways of looking at this new thing that has been put in place as of last Friday. The initial stages of it that's going to go through a transitionary period through the end of the year, unless it is pulled by the current administration, because some of this is a little bit confusing and onerous. But I thought what we'd do is talk a little bit about this, since you've probably been hearing about this, probably getting some emails on this from your brokerage houses and from your advisors where your money is held. And I thought we'd get into this discussion with a guest that has a good amount of knowledge about that. So let's get right to that. And our guest today is Michael Easton. He's president of the Fellowship Financial Group in Orlando. He's also a CPA. And he just has his first book published, Common Sense Income Strategy. So, hey, Michael, congratulations on your book.
Thanks so much, Andrew. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah. How was that? How was that process of writing that book?
It was very tedious. It took a team of people, and we had a great group of researchers and editors and indexers and folks like that. But we got through it.
Yeah, I always... somehow equated to it must be, it was like having, if I was having a baby.
I would never say that to my wife,
no,
though.
Of course. So I wanted to talk to you about today something that a lot of people probably have heard about but don't know a lot about. And that is some of the new regulatory requirements in this, you know, in this environment of we're going to have a lot less regulations, but we have this Department of Labor, this fiduciary rule, this conflict of interest rule that has been recently kind of activated to a degree. But I want to talk to you a little bit about that so a lot of people could understand what it's all about and what's going on about it. So can you give us kind of a quick breakdown about this DOL rule?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in theory, it's a good idea. I mean, it just makes common sense that that we should be acting in the best interest of other people, right? It's a foundational rule. But it's unfortunate that that something like this has to be regulated. I see it more of as kind of an intrusion by the federal government looking at the general public and saying, hey, you guys aren't smart enough to handle this by yourselves, so let us step in there and we'll make sure that everything works out okay. And by the way, we haven't received any taxes from your 401k, so we're trying to figure out a way to make that work as well. But, you know, for those of us who operate, and I do that on two fronts. One is a CPA, and then also our company is a registered investment advisor. It becomes a lot more confusing paperwork than anything else. And I have had several situations just in dialoguing with clients and folks who have attended my classes that it just confuses them. They're not really sure what it really means.
Well, for the most part, from what I understand, the onus is on the advisor to ensure that they are acting in an appropriate manner and also disclosing important information to clients. And it looks to me, at least to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, but this is really squarely initially at least focused on the broker-dealer environment where people were moving their monies from, let's say, an IRA to an IRA or maybe even a 401k or a pension plan to an IRA, and the concern about them being mistreated because 401ks had certain set of maybe fee structures, and now they're going into a full commission situation and being bamboozled in a way. Is that somehow?
Yeah, I mean, you hit it kind of on the head. But the thing is that think about it from a general consumer standpoint. They don't realize that this rule only applies to IRAs.
Right.
So they could be dealing with somebody who is just working with non-qualified assets, meaning non-IRAs, non-401ks, and thinking that the client thinks that, well, they have to operate in a fiduciary way. But that's not necessarily the case with non-qualified assets. So that's one specific area where the consumer's very confused. It makes it difficult for people to tell without knowing that it solely applies to qualified accounts, that they're not working with either the wrong person or they're not moving down the wrong path in terms of investment vehicles.
I mean, we know for a fact that there are many players out there, let's just say, that are really doing a disservice to their clients by not acting in a manner that is client first. We know that has been going on for a long time. We've been fighting that for a long time, you know, because obviously the relationship, you know, you entrust your money to someone to manage it or to invest it in some manner. The idea should be that they are working in your best interest, not just trying to figure out a way to clip you for the highest, you know, commission on some kind of a, you know, a loaded mutual fund or a maybe high priced and commission based variable annuity or something like that. We know that's the case. But let's go back to what this idea of a fiduciary, that's where this all comes up. What's the definition of a fiduciary? What's their responsibility to a client?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, as a fiduciary, that means that you attempt to be objective as best you can, that you're looking out for the best interest of the client as opposed to lining your own pocket. And first of all, let me say that I believe that the majority of people in our industry, they do have their best interests at heart. They do have the client's best interests at heart. They want to do the right thing for the client. But in many cases, their hands are tied. But to be a fiduciary simply means that you're looking out for the best interest of the client at the expense of yourself as it relates to the transactions or the advice that you're providing for them. And that means that just as a fiduciary of a trust or a will, you know, you've got to take on a professional responsibility to carry out the wishes of that estate plan or that will. That's the same thing here. As the person that intended, the way that the person intended for those things to be carried out, and putting the other person first is really the key.
Yeah, but so let's just also then tag on to this whole idea of if it is such a great idea, let's just go with the whole idea that, wow, this program that's being put together, the requirement for this fiduciary rule, this Department of Labor law that's going into place in a bit of a transitionary period, but it's going into law over from now through the end of the year. It's supposed to be fully implemented in January. Let's say, let's just for the moment say it's a good idea. Okay. I know there's some, I mean, we've been looking at some of the stuff and I'm like, that's kind of silly. We do that anyway. You know, what's the point of that? But okay. Let's say it's a good idea. Why in the world is it only then for, as you mentioned, IRAs and 401ks and qualified money and ERISA related assets? Why does this not just spill over into the entire relationship?
Well, listen, I'm not really big on conspiracy theories, and I've had this exact conversation with folks who are professionals in the compliance arena of the investment world. But to me, if you look at what the intention is, and there's been a lot of discussion about, well, how does the government tax or seize 401ks? Well, this could be a way that they take a backdoor approach, a step one from an oversight standpoint, to begin to change the relationship between a consumer and their 401k. So, you know, again, it's just one of those things you start connecting dots, and where does it, and you follow it where the money leads. And unfortunately, I think I mentioned earlier that, yeah, administratively for guys like us who we have to operate that way anyways as a fiduciary, then, and when you understand some of the ways the rules work, then it does it creates a lot more confusion for people. At least currently it does in its current state. So it's just hard to really understand. I mean, like I mentioned before, I've talked to compliance people who have said, I don't know why, but these are some of the things that we come up with. You know, is the government trying to figure out a way to backdoor into taxing qualified plans? Maybe it's the first step in that occurring.
I mean, they could have done it without this, but I hear what you're saying there, that this could be some way of who knows, if you put regulatory requirements, it's not necessarily the government getting that money unless, for example, they say, well, if you're a fiduciary, you're dealing with IRAs, because it is this, you have to get certain kind of, maybe you have to be licensed in a certain way. You know, I mean, some kind of licensure, and they may charge you, I'm just picking a number, $250. And if they do that across the board to all the advisors that are, you know, dealing with this, then that obviously will create some money. But then again, they could have done it with the 401k providers themselves as well. So I'm not exactly sure about this. Now they have, It seems to me, like I said, from a client standpoint, there's not much that has to be dealt with except for the fact that right now I know that a lot of people are getting all sorts of emails with updates from their 401k plan saying there's a very important update advisory for you, which is nothing more than a simple disclosure of sorts. I'm also seeing that annuity companies and mutual fund companies are changing their compensation structure as of today, you know, as of this weekend, because they have to keep in compliance with a level fee base or something else where they can't be charging more than they had charged possibly before, which is where the confusion also comes in. So a lot of people who have, you know, older plans may be grandfathered in, but if you're moving into a new plan, some of this is going to be changing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it can be. But, you know, I would tell you that even some of the big clearinghouses, the big banks, are having a hard time figuring out how to transition into this. Just to give you an example, I had a conversation with a student, and I teach an adult ed class, and I had a student conversation with a student just this morning about this exact issue. She has an advisor with a big bank, and she got a letter from that big bank. I'm not going to name the bank, but I'm sure you've heard of them. And the letter said, well, you know, there are things that are changing, so we've got to have you come in and re-sign some documents. Well, the advisor that she was working with clearly only had a certain type of license, which did not allow him to work with qualified funds. So she was very confused because the advisor said, well, I can still work with you on this account, which is a non-IRA account, but you're going to have to use our investment management team over here for the IRA account. And for the life of her, she couldn't, number one, get the answer out of them as to why that's the case, but they wanted her to re-sign all new documents and things of that nature. So that's where it becomes very confusing for people, not only smaller advisory shops like ours, but also for big banks. They're just, it create that, they don't know how to navigate through it, so they're doing the best they can, but the consumer is the one that's getting really confused.
I would also lay odds that this whole process will also generate somehow, it will manage to happen, that the consumer will get screwed in this deal.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right.
I mean, I got a call from Bank of America today. I don't have accounts. I have some banking accounts there. But they're like, I've never received a call from Bank of America, by the way, ever. I mean, I can't tell you how many years I've been dealing with them, right? Can you come in because we want to talk about your relationship? I'm like, no. No, I don't even know what you mean. You know, my relationship with you is an app or an ATM.
Right.
And I'm very happy with those, by the way. They're very nice. They don't, we don't have conversation, but it works fine. And it's interesting because I'm thinking as that call was going on, I wonder if this is all about them trying to do some outbound marketing in a time of some confusion, not so much the markets per se, but because of this regulation with all this stuff coming in, that they may think about grabbing some new assets and possibly even, who knows, moving you from this place to that place because you have to, quote unquote. So churning your account in a brokerage account to a new funding mechanism because of the new changes here. And I do worry about that.
Yeah, I mean, like, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are so many moving parts here, and who knows what the primary motive is. But I would agree with you, Andrew, that the typically when this kind of thing comes down the pike, the consumer is the one that ends up getting hammered in the long run.
But I mean, the idea is, let's kind of talk about this. So the idea is that an advisor should be a fiduciary and caring for the money and needs and the outlook of the client first, which of course is, when you say it like that, you're like, yeah, so where's the news there, right? I mean, it seems logical. The second thing is that now there's going to be a requirement on IRAs and pension plans and ERISA-related plans that there has to be disclosure as well as adherence to that particular statement for the long haul for the client. That's all a good thing. I do agree, I do believe that is a good thing. I wonder, though, how brokers, you know, traditional brokers, commission-generating transaction-related brokers, are you even going to do any business under this model?
Well, you're right. I mean, other than the fact that that they're going to continue to be able to access and work, do transactions based on non-IRA money, non-qualified accounts. There are still going to be tons and tons of brokerage accounts that exist out there that can be managed by just a traditional Series 7 broker. But when it comes to anything related to qualified funds, then obviously you're going to have to take on that fiduciary responsibility. And it's a very complicated thing for us as advisors, just because, you know, they're talking about this best interest contract that that needs to be present as well, which adds another layer of documentation. So all of those things wrapped up together just make it a challenging thing to try to navigate through.
I mean, I've contacted,
but, you know, we've done it before. It's happened.
I've contacted my compliance.
There are new regulations that have been put in place. We typically tend to figure out how to make it work, and, you know, when we adhere to them. You know, I hope there are some changes, if not pulling this back from our perspective, because our goal is to operate that way no matter what. But I still think there's some opportunity. It's just a limited opportunity for folks who choose not to go the extra mile, and from a licensing standpoint, come up with the licenses required to operate as a fiduciary.
Yeah, because I mean, this best interest contract, I mean, I'm still wondering, because again, we have this transition period here, whether or not this is something that has to be done right away. It's something that's phased in, something we already have by the nature of what we do already, you know, or it has to be a separate document. This, again, those are the things we're talking about. But
right.
But the who gets hurt by this in the 401k complex? Is a company like T. Rowe Price, did they have a problem, or some of these companies that maybe have higher fee structure underlying investments that will have to change this to a flat fee or lower fee type of structure? Is that where it was also aimed at too? Is there something in this whole regulatory fiasco that's going to hurt these companies?
You know, that's a real good question, and I'm not really sure. I mean, it's I think if you look at the companies that are scrambling the most are companies that focused on products that were non-fiduciary, that are sold through non-fiduciary markets. You know, whether it's just an insurance plan or an annuity or something like that. And those companies, I think, are scrambling a little bit more because they had to change their structures, their internal structures, not only to be more competitive, but also to comply with this disclosure rule. Guys who just sell products, if they're just insurance and annuities licensed, for example, they're not used to having to disclose things like compensation.
Right. That's exactly the point, though. That's part of the issue here, is to maybe not force disclosure of compensation, but to have at least on record somewhere that there is a reason for the compensation. That's how I read it.
Yeah, I agree.
So just to kind of sum this up for a second, and to kind of not to bore people to death with all these regulatory issues here, but clients shouldn't be, tell me if you agree with this, but clients don't necessarily have to be that concerned with this. It doesn't really change anything other than the fact that if they are being asked to come in and sign some forms, change their investment program, et cetera, it should be a red flag, first of all, that what do you mean? Why wasn't I in a fiduciary relationship of sorts with you in the first place? Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I do agree with what you're saying, but that's part of the confusion from a consumer standpoint, is they think that unless they've done some study, they think that their advisor's looking out for their best interests when they're, you know, in many cases, they're not obligated to. Again, like I said at the very beginning, I believe most advisors, whether they're just insurance licensed or they're asset managers, I believe they do want to do what's right in the eyes of the client. It's just sometimes it makes it, you know, their hands are tied, or their business model doesn't support that. It's business first, then client second.
Yes.
And if you look at the business model of publicly traded companies, well, that's exactly what it is. It's just, you know, the CEO down, they have the obligation, a fiduciary obligation, to maximize shareholder value, not maximize customer value. That means that that type of reality doesn't have the same effect if you're shopping for groceries or paper towels, but it does have a major impact if you're talking about your retirement finances and your investment accounts.
I mean, but people don't, there's nothing, let's also say there's nothing that anybody has to be concerned with necessarily right now. Nothing is changing for the most part. You know, nobody has to freak out that something's going on. And even if they do get a letter saying, hey, this is a disclosure that you need to look at. Yeah, of course, look at it, read it, see what's going on with it. But there's nothing in this whole plan that changes necessarily anything besides the fact that if you are being asked to change your investment. Now, it's one thing signing a disclosure form saying, hey, I recognize this and this and this. It's another thing entirely if a client is being asked to change their entire investments program that is related to the requirements for this particular rule. That's where the problem could come in.
Yeah, I agree totally with that. You're exactly right.
Right, because that means that maybe you weren't in the right place to begin with and there's something. So, you know, ask your advisor if they know about the DOL rule, the fiduciary rule, the conflict of interest rule. And I think that, you know, you could find out a little bit more about that and understand a little bit more, but again, nothing to be too concerned about. So Michael, where can people find out more about, what you have to offer over there at the Fellowship Financial?
Yeah, they can come to our website. We set up a website primarily right now. It's based on the book, commonsenseincomestrategies.com. That's commonsenseincomestrategies.com. You can read a little bit about the book. You can download a free white paper that we put together called The Red Zone of Retirement. And you can reach out to us through that website as well on our investment company page.
All right. So what I'll do is I'll put the links to commonsenseincomestrategies.com on our show notes also for this as well. You have a Twitter handle?
No, I don't actually.
No Twitter handle. All right. That's okay. Not everybody needs one. Trust me. I spend probably entirely too much time checking out my Twitter, although that's the only one I really use, but I'll make sure to get that up and we'll see. Hopefully we'll see you again in the future.
Sounds great, Andrew. Thanks so much and have a great day.
Thanks, Michael. Bye-bye. You'll definitely be hearing more about that whole issue regarding the Department of Labor rule, or again, the fiduciary rule, probably in the next few months. There's going to be, you know, I think one of the things, and we brought this up with Michael, is that there is a transition period and there's still a big question whether or not this is going to be fully implemented. And there's a lot of questions as to what parts and how much. And I still think, and I had a discussion about this just over the weekend about this. It makes sense that there are fiduciary requirements for the ability to have investors feeling that their advisors are in fact working out in their best interest, working on their plans for the interest of the client. I mean, can you imagine a doctor that was working for you but was trying to upsell you at every occasion? And I guess they do that. But still, the fact is that you need to have the peace of mind as an investor, as a client of an advisor, of a broker, of a, you know, someone who's dealing with your finances, that they are working on in your best interests, not theirs, not trying to find something to sell you, because you're not just coming in as, oh, how much commission can I make on that guy? You're coming in as a client for the long haul, that they're going to do their best to try to ensure that your needs are met. And whether they in fact meet your needs or not is a different discussion in terms of the execution, but in the intent is to be in your best interests. So you'll be hearing more about that over the near future, I believe. Let's talk about some listener questions. And by the way, I always mention this. You can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's a story I wrote last week about, or the week before I wrote, a piece on robo-investing and why it's a problem and why we think there's a much better solution to this whole advisor-based technology-oriented investment process. And we came up with one, which we've talked about many times, called Investology, which we are now in, about to be this week in stage two of the beta. So it's coming, but we want to make sure it's really cherry, really good, and make sure that all of the different areas are covered and you understand what's going on so you can make the most out of it. But you can go over also to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And if you want to ask any questions to me that I'll either answer on the air or directly to you, you can actually do so by clicking on the Ask Andrew button on the top there. I'll take this moment before we get to the listener questions to remind you, by the way, that you also can listen to a great podcast, if you haven't done so already, called DH Unplugged. Myself and John C. Dvorak every Tuesday night live at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. And of course, you can find this on iTunes and any other podcast directory. But we talk about all sorts of interesting business-related and sometimes non-business-related and unrelated topics that you'll find of interest. And we have some games that we play and some great prizes that we give away. It's a lot of fun. A lot of fun. DH Unplugged. You need to check that out. Okay, where are we? All right, let's ask some questions. We got a question from Brian. He says, I'm a new investor and your show was suggested from various articles that I came across that reviewed investment podcasts. I am using the Robinhood app to purchase stocks and I'm holding stocks for at least 1 year. Any advice on the financials that a new investor should focus on to find a company that is undervalued and why financial banks are getting hammered? I'm having a bit of a deja vu here. I feel like I answered this question again before. But anyway, I'll answer it now. Maybe the answer will be different. Maybe it won't. So first of all, the Robinhood app, and you're using that to buy stocks and hold for at least 1 year. So you're really not concerned about the actual trade price because who knows what you're actually getting with those free apps in terms of your execution. We really focus on execution, for example, in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, because we're sometimes trading relatively quickly within days on some positions, and we want to make sure our clients are getting the best execution possible at the price that we want. But nonetheless, okay, so you're holding the stocks for 1 year, and you asked about the financials that you could be looking at to focus on a company that's undervalued. You know, we don't necessarily look at undervalued stocks. We look at more growth-oriented, and we look at things that are not really things that look at, okay, what's the PE value on a relative basis, and what's the price to book. I would go over to FinViz. They have a very good screener there. And you can look at things like price to book, price to earnings, price, the PEG ratio. Look at those for an undervalued circumstance. You know, markets are usually pretty good at valuing stocks, and there must be a reason why the stock is undervalued at a certain period of time. But you find those and look at those according to and in comparison to their peers, and also look at them in comparison to markets. And the second question is, why are financial banks getting hammered? I think that has a lot to do with the yield curve and the concern that the regulations and regulatory market may not be as quick to change things as was expected, not to mention the tax situation with regard to a lowering of corporate taxes. A lot of the controversies and quote-unquote proposed scandals, alleged scandals that are going on, are really putting a bit of a slowing factor into some of the areas that was looked as it would happen very quickly. And therefore, banks, one of the biggest beneficiaries of some of the Trump administration's programs, are being looked at as, well, maybe that's not going to happen so quickly. This one's from Jamie B says, Andrew, I'm a listener to your podcast for about 10 years. Go, Jamie. I enjoy both DH Unplugged and The Disciplined Investor very much. Thank you for all the effort that you put into them. And you're quite welcome, Jamie. My question is in regard to the Federal Reserve holdings in the U.S. Treasuries that you have talked about lately. What are your thoughts on the debt being forgiven instead of slowly unwinding? Seems like this stimulus already built in the economy. The stimulus occurred during a massive destruction of money while the housing market collapsed. Therefore, it should not act as a trigger for inflation. I think that you are correct in that the Fed is going to try to slowly make it look like they're unwinding the debt to, you know, make it look like that they are confident about the economy. And I just do wonder if they will roll off or forgive. The problem with forgiving, even though it is built into the economy, it could really have a negative effect on the U.S. dollar. And that could be really problematic for the rest of the world. I wouldn't put it past them to look to forgive this, but then, you know, who essentially pays that? It's the taxpayer. So that could be a political nightmare, just a total political nightmare. There's a question from Chris K, and he says, I'm a big fan of both your Sunday show and DH Unplugged. On Tuesdays, I have some questions that might be interesting to discuss. He said, and I'm going to just hit one of them because a lot of them on here. Which one should I answer? There's a lot of them here. He has a question regarding, he researched a fund with the symbol FMEIX and compared it on Yahoo to the S&P 500. He says, according to Yahoo, it's doing better than almost all of these other the fund is doing better than the S&P on almost all time horizons. And he looks at a variety of different tools. It looks even better. He says, am I comparing apples to apples? Well, that's a great question because this is not necessarily an S&P 500 fund. It has more mid-cap in there. And the mid-cap did outperform the S&P. So when you're looking at these funds and anybody looking to compare a mutual fund or an ETF to an index, if that's what you feel like you want to do, make sure you compare it to the right index. So this was not the right index to compare it to. If you want to be, it's like saying, well, my bond portfolio is doing better than the S&P 500. It must be really good. That doesn't have any kind of correlation. So make sure that you're definitely comparing it to the right index or its peers, which are even a better way to do things. We like to do a peer comparison. Find the funds that have a very similar goal, the ETFs that have a very similar goal and portfolio structure in terms of investing in either large caps or small caps and value and growth or blend. And then make sure that you are seeing the actual results on a risk-adjusted basis and an actual raw performance basis that are consistent and that are something that is something that you can compare. But trying to just simply compare to the S&P 500 doesn't help anything. He also asked about NVIDIA and a few other things on here. He bought NVIDIA. The price is up about 20% since his buy price. He said, I want to mention, however, that the price seems to drop way below my buy price for some time. And Morningstar tells him the company's overvalued. He works in the IT field. Believe that using the graphic card for number crunching has only started. Yet NVIDIA has a good hardware and software portfolio. What's my take on NVIDIA? We actually own NVIDIA. There was a great article this weekend. I think it was this weekend or last weekend. On NVIDIA as a number crunching tool, particularly for some things like the cryptocurrency markets. Really fascinating piece on that. We like NVIDIA. We do think it's overvalued, by the way. But again, we have a small piece of that in our portfolios, and I think that's a really good place for the long haul. This one's from Rob. Rob says, with the VIX at an all, Rob M. He says, with this VIX at an all-time low, is there any reason why I shouldn't be investing in one of those ETFs and ETMs? Is my only risk the contango and roll while waiting for the volatility to come? You know, it depends on which particular ETF you're investing in. The VIX ETFs that are multiples of, and even the single times, but the multiple leverage ETFs really perform badly due to the rolling issues. So forget about contango and all that. The roll is just really tough on those share prices. It's almost like you want to always be short all of these. I would rather you use an option if you feel compelled to get into the VIX. Buy an option a few months down the road, a little bit out of the money, and then ride that and keep on rolling it if you want to continue owning it. So those are really problematic. We had a few more here. Let's see. I have this one's from Nick. He says, I'm a big fan of your podcast. I'm very grateful for the discussions and interviews that you're conducting. Quite a significant contribution to the financial education of your listeners. Hey, Nick, thank you. I have a question regarding long-term investment for retirement. I'm 29. Have started an ETF layaway plan with a couple of years to go. I've implemented this as my disciplined way of ensuring to invest in a diversified set of assets for the long term as a retirement booster in 40 years' time or so. I'm now struggling the current portfolio situation. While most indices are close to all-time highs, I start to wonder whether it would make sense for me to take some of the gains or sidelines the proceeds into the next dip, or do I have to stay disciplined, regularly balancing? First of all, Nick, you do whatever you want to do. If in fact, though, you want to be in a portfolio like this, if this is something that you believe is a good long-term proposition, you stick to the sequence of what you're doing. Now, that doesn't preclude you from opening up another portfolio with a different strategy to diversify this. But basically, if this is a part and parcel of your long-term plan that we know has some good footing in disciplined investment process and in overall portfolio theory, I don't know why all of a sudden you're going to start saying, well, I think it's time to get out. So now you're going to mix a disciplined, rebalancing, structured portfolio with a market timing portfolio? That doesn't make any sense. Again, I'm feeling like I answered some of these questions. I don't think so, because I would have checked them off, but I didn't. Anyway, that's all we have for questions right now. Actually, I got two more that we'll hold off to next show. But of course, go over to the Disciplined Investor. And if I did answer these questions, I apologize, by the way. I may have. But lots happening here, and we're trying to keep it all organized. We have some great guests coming up. Of course, some of your favorites that will be on in the near future, like Das. And of course, we just had Frank Curzio. We'll have some of the other favorites and some new ones. I always like to have new discussions with people I haven't talked to in the past for the educational purposes. I learn a lot, by the way. That's one of the reasons I do the show, is because I learn a tremendous amount, not only in the preparation on a weekly basis, but also from our guests. I mean, where else could I get this kind of great one-on-one opportunity with many of the players that we have on the show each and every week? It's great, not only for you, but it's great for me. So that's why we do this. Go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, check out all the different strategies that I mentioned. And again, I talk about how the markets are looking a little bit toppy here, that maybe some time for you to think about diversifying a little bit, and that's what we offer. Also, listen to DH Unplugged. DHUnplugged.com is the place to listen to it each and every Tuesday evening and find out the show notes and everything that we're talking about, the great charts that we put up, as well as the games like the Close to the Pin, the Old Codgers versus the Millennials portfolio, and the weekly stock picks that we have each and every week. Until next week, I'd like to say thank you for joining me. Hopefully, we're going to stay dry for the rest of the week down here, and you stay warm wherever you are. I'll see you soon. Thanks again.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.